prosperity of later years. His talk tonight is on farming and the famine.
Okay. Yes. Well, what I'm going to try to do is combine two things, my own interest in farming, and then, of course, the discussion that's been going on for a few years now about the famine and what it means and how people are thinking about it nowadays and maybe reinterpreting it, or not reinterpreting it, saying that the original interpretations and understanding of it were very good. The big historical debate, or one of the big historical debates about the famine, is did it really have a big effect on life in Ireland? Was the effect of the famine? It used to be thought, without question, really, that the famine was the big event of the 19th century, that nothing could come near it in terms of just the impact it had on Irish life. Now, in recent decades, I suppose, some historians have been saying, well, it was a big catastrophe, of course, it was an immense catastrophe, but did it really change the course of Irish history? Could we say that the famine really changed the course of Irish history? Now, my own view at the outset is, yes, we can say that the famine changed the course of Irish history. Whether it was the most significant event in the 19th century depends what you mean by significant, but I think there's no doubt at all that it really affected the lives of virtually everybody in the island and changed the whole shape and look, in fact, of the island. Now, I want to try to show you why I think this using the example of farming. Some of you, when I come to a place, I say this to Malachy all the time, when I come to a place like the Glens of Antrim, I always feel a bit sheepish talking about farming because you're also well informed here, not only about modern farming, but farming in the past, that you'll have to forgive me if sometimes I sound as if I'm being a bit basic here because I give this talk to a lot of people who don't know about farming. To ease the boredom and really make it more interesting, I hope I'm going to use slides. So I'll start doing that. Now, the 19th century, 1800 to 1900, when you think about it, had as big an effect, or there were as big changes in the 19th century as there have been in this century. In almost any aspect of life, you care to think about, life changed utterly during that 100 years between 1800 and 1900. If you think of politics, in 1800, Ireland, the Act of Union hadn't been passed. Ireland wasn't officially part of the United Kingdom. By 1900, it was part of the biggest empire in the world. If you think of transport, in 1800, people, and especially places like the Glens of Antrim, were still using horse-drawn vehicles without any wheels on them. That were very common. By 1900, the motor car was there. So, and the whole field of technology and politics and attitudes to life, the changes really in that century were as big as the changes in this century. Now, in farming life, you had the same huge, immense changes in the way people farmed the land. Having said that, you can split farming into two levels. What the improvers used to call common systems of farming, what the ordinary people did, what the very poor people did, and then improved farming, large-scale, commercial, technological, scientific farming. Now, I want to go through these two sorts of farming in the pre-famine years, just to give you an idea of the kinds of farming that were practiced in the early 19th century, but also to show the kind of changes of the famine and what happened in the middle of the century made to this. Now, at the turn of the 1800s, Irish farmers, and most of them, were extremely poor. They lived by manual labour. They used spades to turn the earth, and they used a whole series of hand tools, which I'll be going through. And some of the techniques that these very poor farmers were using were very, very ancient indeed. One of them was making ridges. A lot of you will know them, but rigs, they'd be called, I suppose, in the Glens a lot of the time. And you can still see them. I'll be showing the sides of that and the disused ones. But ridges are one of the most ancient things in Ireland. This is a slide from County Mayo, from North Mayo. And under these feet, 2 or 3 feet, 4 feet, of Peatborg, you can see Stone Age agricultural ridges still surviving after, say, 5,000 to 6,000 years. So that this is an incredibly ancient system of agriculture, an incredibly refined system of agriculture, very labour intensive, and ideally suited the conditions of the rural poor in Ireland during the 19th century. If you want to think of the typical Irish agricultural implement, it's certainly the spade. There are more types of spade in Ireland than I would say in any other, probably any other country in the world. Certainly we don't know of any other country in the world that would have as many types of spades. There are literally hundreds of types of spades. One spade mill in County Tyrone in the 1830s made 230 different types of spade, each one of the spades in three sizes, and that was just one spade mill. There were more than 60 spade mills in Ulster at that time. So you can imagine the immense variety of spades that there were. And all of them made sense. All of them were designed to do a particular job in a particular sort of land at a particular sort of height and slope. Very, very refined system of farming. And this, of course, which is only a bit of a slide, because it's one of the most famous early photographs, and of course it's very Glens of Antrim. These two girls in either Glenshesk or Armoy. We always have a discussion about that. And are they Macaulays or are they McAllisters? But anyway, two girls making spade ridges. So this ancient system of spade or ridge making persisted not only until the turn of the century when these two women were making these ridges, but still today we go to a ploughing match in County Leitrim every Easter Saturday. And one of the competitions in the ploughing match is making ridges with spades. There's been a huge revival in it. There's now a Loy Association. A Loy is a one-sided spade. A Loy Association of Ireland. And as far as I know, the last national championship, ploughing championships, there were over 200 spadesmen took part. So this Stone Age method of turning the ground is still used today. So this system of manual labour and hard labour, but very refined, was going on really right throughout the 19th century. The system went right through the system of hard labour, manual work, but great skill, went right through from planting to harvest. You planted your crops by hand and you harvested them by hand. This was the great tool of the Irish farmer, Irish agricultural labourer, until well into the century. It's a toothed sickle, a sickle with little saw-like teeth on it. Irish reapers or harvesters were extremely famous for it. Thousands of Irish people, men and women, went over to Britain every year to help in the harvest there during the harvest months in the grain harvest. And their labour was so cheap and they were so skillful that they actually held up the introduction of the scythe to the grain harvest in parts of England like Yorkshire, because farmers could hire these big, large teams of Irish reapers and get the hay, or sorry, the grain cut more neatly and just as quickly as they could using local scythesmen, and just as cheaply. So a very, very skilled task, and very typical of this sort of agriculture, which really used a lot of skill and very little equipment. It went right through the threshing. This is another famous photograph, of course, taken near Tonebridge, of two men using flails. And the flail, again, is a very simple implement. Almost anybody could make one, but requires a lot of skill to use it. And of course, the ultimate crop, really, as far as Ulster farming history was concerned, was flax. And it, until the 1920s, you harvesting flax used no implement at all, because it was all pulled by hand. So very, very typical of this crop, and which really changed the shape of the Ulster landscape from the 18th right through to the mid-19th century onwards. So this is our flax crop in the museum, which we grow every year. Now, so what I'm trying to show you is a system of farming, as I say, using a lot of labour, a lot of small implements or none, and an awful lot of skill. And that went on right through, and in fact, as I said, goes right through from the Stone Age and in some cases right through to the present day. This was known as the common system of farming. It was very much decried, very criticised, condemned by people who didn't know better, called agriculture improvers, in the early 19th century, apart from a few very bright ones. But at the same time as this system of farming was happening in the 19th century, it was another system also evolving. This was the great age of agriculture and improvement, the age when the world was being turned upside down and farming was being turned upside down by developments in technology. And I'll just show you a couple of examples of this. And this is one that one implement that changed very fast in Ireland during the early 19th century, the plough. This is the best illustration we have of what was known as the old Irish long-beamed plough. It's an etching or an engraving done near Hillsborough, County Down, in 1783. And it's a wonderful drawing. The original's only about an inch and a half high, and you can see when it's blown up to this height, it's still really, really clear. A fantastic illustration. It shows an old wooden plough pulled by four horses and operated by two people. Quite often required three people because somebody had to lie in the beam to hold it into the ground. Another lovely thing about it, I think, is it shows Sugan harness of plaited straw, which is very traditional in Ireland. But you can see why improvers might initially have criticised it, because compared to the ploughs I will show you in the near future, in just a minute in fact, it needed four horses to operate. Sometimes it needed six horses to operate. It needed somebody to lead the horses, somebody to work the plough, and somebody probably to lie on the beam. So you learned a lot of people and a lot of animals to work it. Agriculture and improvers said it didn't turn the ground well either. It didn't throw the sod over very evenly. A colleague of mine, Mervyn Watson, has shown that actually in some particular sorts of undrained ground where grain was being grown, it was actually a very efficient plough before underground drainage came. But the improvers, in Wales, had a point. You need an awful lot of horses and an awful lot of people to operate it. Sorry, I'll just move this a wee bit. Right. Now, this was the great age of improvement. So at the level which we would know as strong farming or commercial farming or big farmers, a lot of change was happening. And this is the Farming Society of Ireland, which was founded by the Dublin Society, really later the Royal Dublin Society. And this medal in 1815 shows you what these improvers saw as the apex, the height of ploughing technology. And you can see immediately one person operating it, only two animals, in this case oxen. There was a big fashion for oxen among gentlemen farmers, rich farmers around the turn of the century, and a small, much smaller plough with, by this stage, a metal mouldboard on it. This was called a swing plough. It was a type developed in Scotland by a very famous Scottish improver called James Small. And it really was designed very scientifically, mathematically, to turn the ground according to Small's calculations of the curve of the mouldboard. And as I say, it only needed one person and two animals to operate it. Now, the notion was that Irish farmers at the time, a lot of the improvers said Irish farmers were innately conservative, that they were lazy, they were slothful, that they didn't really care about improvement. Now, as I've just hoped to show you, the early stage, this is totally misunderstanding the small-scale farming that practices that people were using. And in fact, when people saw these ploughs, commercial farmers in Ireland, or ordinary farmers in Ireland with a slightly larger farm, saw these ploughs and saw the advantage of them, they changed to them very, very quickly. We all know nowadays that farmers change very fast when something goes wrong with farming, or there's something incentive from Brussels. And it was the same in the early 19th century. The farmers were not irrational, conservative creatures. If they saw the point of something, they changed very quickly. So within 30 years in the early 19th century, this plough had become the most common plough in Ireland. These Scottish swing ploughs had become the Irish plough all over the country. They were ideally suited to bumpy land, to hilly land, to slopes, because the depth of the plough in the ground and the width of the furrow could be adjusted very, very sensitively by the farmer as he was ploughing. So a major advantage in the sort of farms you would get around, obviously, the Glens of Antrim. And indeed, the Glens of Antrim, this is a picture taken in the Folk and Transport Museum. This is the house from Cosh Kidd, a hill farm which I'm sure a lot of you know. The Glens of Antrim is the last big stronghold in the north, sadly dying out now, of swing ploughing. These swing ploughs, The only place where you'll see them in a plough and match outside the Folk Museum is at the Ballycastle plough and match on St Patrick's Day. So this great tradition of using swing ploughs survived in the Glens of Antrim, really up to the present as far as a hobby goes and a competition plough. But you can see they're very beautiful ploughs, they're very streamlined. By the middle of the 19th century, by the time the famine was coming, they were made out of all iron. The mouldboards were cast in foundries. Blacksmiths would buy bits of metal from foundries and make the rest of the ploughs up in the forges. But very beautiful, very graceful sort of ploughs, and requiring a lot of skill and brilliance to use them. This is a picture from the Glens as well, and this shows, I really put it in because of the scenery, it doesn't really show very clearly, but one of the great things that the improver said was happening to agriculture in the early 19th century was what we would call nowadays the appliance of science. The boastings of these improvers, these scientific farmers, knew no bounds. They said that by applying science and mathematics and physics to farming, at one point they were saying they would even be able to grow grain, they'd be able to grow crops of grain on the top of Ben Nevis in Scotland, because if you applied science, nothing was impossible to agriculture. Now, one of the great triumphs of this improved approach to farming was the cultivation of drills, the notion of planting crops in drills. Now, this was part of the English agricultural revolution. I'm sure all of you have heard of Jethro Tull, who invented the process in the 1720s. A drill is simply a long, straight row. You plant your crops in long, straight rows at equal distances from one another. And this allows very controlled planting of the crop, care and management of the crop, and also harvesting of the crop. In Ireland, again, the farmers took to it very, very quickly. And the cultivation of potatoes in what we call raised drills, that's really the way you see potatoes still being grown in the fields around now, in these sort of triangular broken up drills and long straight rows, swept Ireland during the 1830s. So the travellers going around the country in the 1830s were saying that the old ridge method of cultivation I was shown earlier, in the lowlands anyway, had been completely replaced by this drill cultivation of potatoes, where they were systematically put in and looked after and harvested using a whole range of horse-drawn equipment. So the appliance of science by the 1830s seemed to be really putting agriculture on a great march forward. Another thing, right through the whole farming process, nothing seemed to be resisting the onward march of progress. Even threshing grain, that's beating the grain, the seeds out of the heads of the grain, had become mechanised. This is a horse-drawn threshing machine. There are horses outside the barn turning a system of gears, which turns the drums inside the thresher, which beats the heads off the grain. These were being introduced to Ireland as early as 1801, and by the 1840s were being manufactured by foundries such as Kennedy's of Coleraine. They were manufacturing them and selling in the foundries. You can see a lot of it's cast iron, so you needed a foundry. And the foundries were spreading throughout Ireland in the 1830s and manufacturing these really quite major pieces of engineering. And again, you can see very scientific, very mechanised, and the march of progress. So the big question is, what happened? Well, what happened was the famine. Because while we're talking about all this march of progress, let's remember back to the early slides where we're talking about the common system of farming. Between 1750 and 1845, the population of Ireland may have almost multiplied by four times. It used to be thought it had doubled, but in fact, modern economic historians are saying that the population actually might have increased fourfold during the 100 years before the famine. It was the fastest growing population in Europe, and it seems likely that by the time of the famine, there were about 8 to 9 million people, almost 9 million people, living in Ireland. Now, these people, the very great paradox of this was that these people were crowded on to the poorest land. In other countries where the population was growing, you got a big drift away from the land very early on. Like England was famous for this. This was the time of the growth of the big industrial cities. And in Ireland, the cities were growing as well, but not fast enough to absorb the population. So what you got was the rural poor moving up onto the hillsides and out onto the peat bogs, desperately looking for a tiny patch of land. Now, the only reason why they could survive on this sort of land at all was because of the wonderful techniques of ridge making and the other manual techniques I showed you at the start of the slides. They were able to use their labour and their amazing skill to actually just keep their families alive. And they could do it using the wonder crop of the age, which of course was the potato. So the population, if you imagine it swarming, literally swarming, at the local people or travellers around the country over time, were swarming up all over the hillsides, over and out onto the bogs, and these tiny wretched cabins were being built everywhere. Now, it does away with the notion, really, that the Irish landscape is in some way unchanging. You get that a lot. Writers are bewitched by the beauty of our country, and the incredible ancient monuments that you get say that the Irish landscape in some way is timeless. Well, you can see what they mean in a sort of poetic way, but in actual fact, in terms of the way the landscape looked before the famine, it looked incredibly different. There was far, far more land under crops, and particularly the crops were on the hillsides. Up right up until the very highest hills, you could see the traces. Even still, you can see the traces of where these people grew either potatoes or oats to keep themselves alive. So the landscape would have looked actually very, very different from what it does today. So what you got just before the famine was teeming masses of unbelievably poor people living on the bogs and the mountains. I think the level of poverty is impossible for us really to understand. There are descriptions from North Mayo in the 1840s of people living in what we call Donegal are called bogs or bogi, which are half built into the ground. They're actually almost half underground. And there are descriptions of the people not having enough clothes to cover their bodies, that of women and children walking around picking up shreds of sheep's wool to try to get to collect it so that they could spin it and weave it into a garment just to make their bodies decent before they could actually go out into the world. Now, if you imagine, well, you can't, I think our imaginations break down trying to imagine what it must have been like to wake up in an underground, something dug into a peat bog with a fire, okay, but with literally not enough clothes to cover your body. And I think this is one of the things that historians have been discussing about the famine, is that these people, millions of them, were actually below history. And that's why, in a way, as in all famines, there is a great silence. They were the silent people, quite literally. Because they were below history, a lot of them, their lives went totally unrecorded. So what you were getting before the famine was this mass of desperately poor people. People, travellers through Ireland, were becoming increasingly horrified at the sights they were seeing, particularly in the mountains and bogs of the west. This is just one of just to show you what the sort of conditions people were living in. This was, I suppose, the most notorious form of dwelling, and that was particularly common in Connacht. It was known as a scalp, and a scalp, there's an Irish word scalp, which means like a fissure or a crack in the ground, and these things seem to be just straw or hay and wood built over some sort of natural slit in the ground, and people were actually living in these things all the time. So you can imagine that the level of poverty, well, you'll say we can't. As the famine approached, as we got into the 1840s, these people were living more and more on a knife edge. They had incredible skills for getting crops, the potatoes, to keep their families alive out of poorer and poorer land. As the population increased, the people were going higher and higher up the mountains. Landlords generally had different approaches to this mass movement onto the wasteland under the estates, what was known as wasteland. Most landlords quite liked it because these people, because of the incredible labour they were putting into the land, were actually improving the quality of this wasteland and actually bringing it into cultivation. So some landlords actually laid out the wasteland in with stone walls and even built houses and then let these out. A lot of them let the people settle on the land free for the first 7 years, and they started charging rent after the 7 years, and give grants and a bit of help, loans of seed and animals, so that the people could survive while they were setting themselves up. The majority of landlords just let it happen, just let the people move up onto the land, and once they settled themselves, start charging them a rent. It would have been a pretty tiny rent that would have got out of the people, but it was fine because it meant that the estate was being improved, the land was being improved. The most notorious of the landlords, they were probably only a small number, but certainly were notorious. What they would do is move the people up the mountain. When they broke that bit of land in, they would move them higher up the mountain again, and higher and higher. And even where that wasn't happening, you can imagine under the population pressure, people were moving higher and higher up into the hills to a much more marginal environment. And so the potato crops were beginning to fail anyway. And then in 1845, the blight hit the potato crop. Now, came across from America, came through Europe, and it hit Ireland in August in 1845. It was first recorded in the Botanical Gardens in Dublin, and the first place in the Irish countryside was actually in Fermanagh. And people who were actually aware of the situation in Ireland realised that the most terrible catastrophe was about to happen. The death started. The first year, the potato crop, probably between a half and a third and a half of the potato crop failed, although some places were much worse. Around Ballymoney in County Antrim, two-thirds of the potatoes failed. That was in 1845. In 1846, the potato crop nearly failed almost entirely, and the situation went on really throughout the 1840s, some years slightly better, some years slightly worse. This is a drawing from the Illustrated London News from Skibbereen in County Cork, one of the worst affected areas. And by the 1846-1847, even the most cynical commentators realised that the immensity of the catastrophe. And the government began to respond to this. As early as 1845, relief committees were set up, and there were about 1,000 of these set up in different parts of the country. And then the government tried various different kinds of relief systems. My own impression is, I'm not really here to talk about the famine as such, but is that if you read the government writings, in the initial stage there was a lot of reaction, oh, this is the Irish moaning again, and then slowly the realisation of the immensity of the famine hit, and by 1846 and 1847 there's almost an atmosphere of panic. The relief schemes were notoriously difficult to manage. There were all sorts of abuses. They didn't often pay the people enough money for them to be able to afford the food locally. And by 1847, the government began to realise that the only thing to do was actually to feed the people. There was a big reluctance in the Victorian times to handing out free food. It was thought that it would encourage a culture of dependency, that people would make them work shy, all the rest of it. As somebody said, these commentators, they made Mrs. Margaret Thatcher seem like a real softie. They didn't. They were really. They believed very religiously, almost, in the free market. They thought if you interfered with the market, buying and selling at a particular price, it would destroy civilization. Now, at first sight, this seems a brutal, and in fact, I would say, quite clearly, was a brutal way to look at this immensity of human suffering. But having had discussions when we did our famine exhibition in the museum with people from Trocra and Oxfam, there is a level actually at which it does begin to make sense, because what they find is when these third world agencies are going into famine areas, what they find is if there's a huge dump of free food into the country, it puts the ordinary traders, the ordinary merchants out of business. They can't cope with the competition. And if the famine goes on for any length of time, what you find is the whole ordinary mechanisms of this kind of trade and, in fact, food distribution break down, so that when the famine goes away, the whole ordinary mechanism of markets and shops and fairs has disappeared, and it's very, very hard to get the thing up and running again. So there is a kind of that kind of marginal justification for this reluctance to interfere with the ordinary mechanisms of trade. Here, of course, it, as I say, it was regarded with as a religion, and it wasn't until the people started dying literally by the million that they realized that this, whatever you thought about trade, it wasn't working. Again, one of the things that we find hard to understand is that a lot of the relief schemes introduced by the government were really designed to last for a year and then stop. Now, and with hindsight, it's easy to condemn this kind of approach, but we have to remember that what the hope was every year when the harvest came, that the harvest would be okay, that the disease would go away, the harvest would be okay, and things would go back to normal again. So really, a lot of the relief schemes were from harvest to harvest. But as I say, by the 1847, it was recognised that the catastrophe was just beyond any kind of notion of an ordinary food shortage or even a minor famine. Cormac O'Grada, who's one of, I think, the best historians of the famine, has shown that, in fact, the Irish famine was much worse in its intensity than even the worst of the Third World famines nowadays. So by 1847, even the most cynical of these free traders was saying they'd better just feed the people. So by 1847, soup kitchens were introduced on a massive scale, government soup kitchens. And in the summer of 1847, it was estimated that half the population of Ireland, about 3.5 million people, were being fed, kept alive by soup kitchens. Now, it was one solution that worked very, very well. The system of distribution in a lot of cases actually worked. And during the summer of 1847, the people that were being kept alive. One of the hardest things to understand is that in the autumn, the soup kitchens were just closed up, and the government then said, have to go back to the relief schemes, and of course, the workhouse. Now, workhouses, I'm sure even I remember my granny talking about the workhouse in Belfast with tones of dread. Workhouses were built in Ireland around the 1830s, 1840s. They were built to hold 100,000 people, and they were regarded with horror and fear by the people even in ordinary times. They were explicitly designed so that life inside the workhouse was worse than life outside the workhouse. So the guardians of the workhouse would look at what the diet of the ordinary people was outside the workhouse and then give the people in the workhouse a bad version of that, a poorer version of that. And again, the notion was to discourage malingering. Families were split up and put in long communal dormitories. The food, as I say, was very bad, and the people, even in ordinary times, hated and feared having to go into the workhouse. But during the famine, people could not wait to get into the workhouse. And this was even in what we think of as very prosperous areas, like Ballymena and County Antrim, the heart of prosperous linen weaving, mid-Victorian Ulster. There were three times as many people trying to get into the workhouse as the workhouse could hold. In Enniskillen workhouse, women were dying of cold. In Lurgan workhouse, there were hundreds of people just dying of various diseases. And I think this is one of the things about any famine, which I hadn't realised before I started working with the Third World agencies, that in most famines, more people die of disease than of starvation. It's only quite a small minority of people who die directly from starving to death. Most people die of a whole series of famine-related illnesses. I think one of the saddest things is that even diseases which didn't kill people initially just went like wildfire in the famine. And the workhouses were one of the great centres of disease, because people were crowded, all these desperate people were crowded close together, so any kind of contagious disease or fever just went like wildfire throughout the people. And so this is why when we talk about the famine having regional effects, it's certainly true that the potato failure was worse in some areas than others. It's certainly true that people, depending on the potatoes, were more in the west. But the diseases spread everywhere. It was estimated that one person in five in Belfast was sick with famine fever. So that even in areas that weren't affected by the starvation, the famine took a terrible toll. Now, in terms of farming, I think the most aspect of it that most significant is the evictions that happened during the famine. And I think this is the area, when you're trying to be a historian or trying to understand the past, you have to try in a way to put your own prejudice aside, none of us can do it, but you have to try it. And thinking things through, you can actually see sometimes why people would say, no, we don't want to interfere with free trade, we don't want to hand out just free food, we want to give people money, build up self-help kind of schemes. I think really from our modern sensibilities, our moral sense now, the hardest thing to understand are the evictions. It was estimated in the last 5 years of the famine, probably a quarter of a million people, were put out of their houses. Now, the justification was that because the government wouldn't give outdoor relief, that is, like soup kitchens, the people had to go to the workhouses. They wouldn't go to the workhouses. Surprise, surprise. And so the only way to get them out there was to knock the houses down around them and make them go. A more cynical understanding of it, and I think probably a more accurate one, is that the sheer weight of the poverty that was being borne a lot by the equivalent of tithes and rates, the landed people with property, people with big farmers and big landlords, the government was trying to force them more and more to look after the poor in their own area. Now, if you don't want to be looking after massive amounts of poor, the easy way is really to get rid of them. And so I think a more cynical view of this would be that it wasn't at all for the people's own good. It was to relieve the poor relief on the people in the area. I think in a way, though, it is brutality. Suffering begets brutality and suffering. These people, a lot of estates, big landed estates, went bust because of the famine. Just the sheer weight of call from poor relief schemes and the lack of rents and landlords, and a lot of them actually did get severely into debt during the famine. And I think that kind of thing of everybody suffering can create either a very noble response or it can create a very vicious response. And certainly the evictions seem to be one of the more vicious ones. The other thing that happened, of course, was that the people left the land. Between 1850 and 1900, probably 4 million people left Ireland. The floodgates just opened and people just left by hundreds of thousands. Droves and droves of people were just leaving the land. So these areas of hillside and bog, which had been covered, swarming with people, were suddenly empty. And that's why when you go to the west today and go to North Mayo, you see these beautiful empty boglands and hills. It looks as if no one has ever lived there. And it's hard really to imagine what it would have been like when all those people were swarming over them. And they left their traces. This is Clare Island, County Mayo. And you can see here all of the disused ridges. These are overgrown spade ridges that would have been dug or built up just before the famine. And you can see the trace. I suppose the great memorial of the famine, or off, certainly off the poor people's struggle to get a living out of the land. This is not a very good picture. I was just trying to show they're all over the glens as well. You can see here, this is above Glenarm ridges. There are far more spectacular examples all around the glens. In fact, the glens are one of the best places to see these old disused ridges. And I suppose they're the great memorial to the people who lived in the famine and after the famine as well, because the movement from the land didn't happen immediately, it happened slowly. I suppose the thing that the animal that reacted most dramatically, or whose fate was most closely tied up with humans during the famine, was the pig. This is, I think, the weirdest sort of pig. This is the Irish greyhound pig, which was very common in the early 19th century. But pigs, the poor pigs, suffered very directly with the human beings. Just before the famine in 1841, it was estimated that there were 2.5 million pigs in the country. By 1848, there were 500,000. So 2 million pigs vanished in 7 years. Now, the reason was that pigs and humans have a very close relationship, and pigs' basic food was the potato. So when the potatoes went, the pigs went. So the most spectacular result of the famine during the famine years was the disappearance of the pig. During the famine, though, and I think